My name is Jan Frischow. Hi, everybody. And I am a very grateful recovering Al-Anon, but most of all, I am a recovering child of a father that I have finally recovered my relationship with through these 12 steps. And that's the most important thing in my life today. I want to tell you what an honor it is to be here. Anytime I'm asked to share in a meeting, it doesn't matter the size or where it is or how many showed up, and it was looking pretty grim a while ago, I'll tell you. This reminds me of "And the Sleeping Shall Rise." I mean, they're just coming. It was, you know, I want to tell y'all what you missed. Everyone who got here early got these flowers. We didn't even have to have a drawing. And it was like, boom, they were all down here and they all got their flowers. So anyway, I told him, I said, you should have never put it in the announcements that there was going to be a business meeting. You should have said free drawings and things like that. You don't ever put in there about business meetings. But it's a real honor to be here today. It's an honor to stand before all of you and be able to share my life and things with you that before I couldn't even face myself. And now I'm telling everybody. I'll never forget the lady that when I first came into Al-Anon, and she 12-stepped me and eventually became my sponsor for a short while because she didn't have a sponsor and she didn't know what a sponsor was. So she sponsored me for a little while, but she told me one time, she said, you know, I couldn't believe I was going to take my fifth step and tell people everything I'd done. And she said, now I could stand up in Pizza Hut and do it. And I kind of feel that way. You know, people who are not in the program and haven't experienced the freedom that we have, that we are given, you know, it says, you know, after we write this written inventory, and we are given the promise of the fifth step before we ever take it. Did y'all notice that? It says in the big book, it says, for we are building an arch through which we will pass a free man at last. Well, I say women can do it too, even though it just says man. I added that part. Sort of like the Bible, you know. They're a little bit on the male side there. But anyway, you know, we are given that promise. It's like that little carrot that hangs out there that we're going to pass into freedom. And I can meet somebody and I'll just be telling them all about my past now. And they're kind of looking at me like, God, you know, she's just telling us all this stuff. And my husband still doesn't understand it today, you know. He keeps everything such a secret, you know, and kind of compressed with the outside world. And I realize now why he has to, because he doesn't know that it's okay for them to know. He does not know that. And he's kind of learning that through being married to me. I mean, what chance does he have? Some people say, have you ever tried to say no to you? And I say, no. Nope. If I ask myself for something, I say, yes, you can have it. But anyway, he's learning that you can have that freedom. And so I'm so honored to be here. And I want to thank Ann and the committee for having me here and for my beautiful room. It was real hard at times to get out of that room because we are given what we want and we are given what we need in this program. I found that my needs and my wants match today. They used to didn't match, but they do today. And I sat up there after I went up to my room last night. It was after 11 when I got up there. And I threw the windows open. And I moved the table out of the way. They put all the stuff in the way of that beautiful view, you know. They had the chairs on the outside. And I threw it all to the other side of the room. And I pulled my chair up to where I could hang out that window. And I hung out that window for over an hour. And I looked at the beauty. And I thought about the difference between the people living down at the bottom part of that look up at it and the people that live up on the top and they look down on it. That's where I used to be in life. I used to be down there looking up at it, and I thought I could never get there. I was raised in a religious home, but it wasn't a spiritual home. So I thank you for that room, and I thank you for that view. If I'd had to look out at the center of the building here, I would have missed most of what I needed here today. And I want to also tell you that anything I say today is strictly my experience. It's not just my opinion. Okay? I've experienced things in only the way that I can. I can tell you about my experience, but they are my experiences and I own them. It was a long time before I could stand behind the podium of an AA podium or an Al-Anon podium, either one, and say the fact that I was a battered wife. Now, my husband, when he made his AA talk, he'd get up and talk about it, you know. And but it's like part of the deal for me was that I was responsible to keep the secret. And it was, I'll never forget the first time that I stood behind a podium and said I was a battered wife. And I was shaking all over. I still to that day felt like I was betraying him. Everybody already knew it. You know, he probably still doesn't give an AA talk today that he doesn't tell about it. But that was part of my disease, was keeping secrets. That was part of it. So, I sat here this morning and I listened to those traditions. I get so caught up. You know, this thing about feel the power of the very words. That's what was missing in my life, you know. I was powerless. And then the power was added when I came in and I started working those steps. And I listened, and for some reason, there's been two things that have been going through my mind all weekend. And one of them is conscious contact. Conscious contact. Conscious contact. And then every time I'd hear the traditions read, it's just when the steps are read and the traditions are read, I just want to close my eyes and just feel them because of the healing power of the words. And I really feel that in so much of our literature. It's just like amazing, amazing that they knew how to write that, and they really didn't. They really didn't. I know that today, that it came through them and not from them. But the power of those steps led me to a spiritual awakening. I sat out there yesterday and I thought, my God, Bob's going to give my whole talk. I won't have anything to say tomorrow. You know, it's sort of like that. I go through different stages of what I'm supposed to talk about, and it kind of changes as I change and as I grow. But the thing that has been most important to me, when Ann called me the second time to find out when I was coming in, she said, I said to her, when am I going to be speaking? And she said, well, I know. Would you like to know? I said, yeah, I'd like to know. She said, Sunday morning. And I said, oh, wonderful. That's my favorite time to talk. She said, I know. I gave you a choice, and that's what you told me you wanted. I said, well, I don't remember that. But anyway, it is, because it's sort of like I don't have to have the excuse to give a spiritual talk. But that's my favorite subject, is to talk about the spirit of this program and the spirit that lives in me because of this program. But these steps, as I worked them, brought me right down to that promise that Bob talked about on the 12th step. When I got to this program, I'm going to give you just a little concise definition of my life. I was a basket case of negative emotions. That's what I was. That was on my very best day, that's what I was. I was in a spiritual coma. I no more had a God of my understanding. I had a God at First Church of God, Spalp, Oklahoma. I grew up with some of the most powerful musical figures that are out there on the markets and the shelves of the places today. In the same churches with them, singing with them, going to church with them, knowing them. And somehow I sat in that same the same meetings, and I missed it all. I don't know how I missed it. And I was there. I want to tell you, I was there. Even when the missionaries got together to rip the sheets, I was there. Okay? We lived in the basement of our church in a three-room apartment. So I knew what that church was like. And when the doors were open, my little Fanny was in a pew. Now, somehow those other people caught some stuff that I didn't catch. And I know, I used to believe, especially when I first got in the program, I used to believe that they couldn't possibly have the freedom and the understanding that I had since I had worked those steps and found my freedom. I have since learned that they certainly did. Now, that may come as a shock, but I mean, it's really evident to me, because I had a brother that was sort of like me, and he didn't catch it. But then I had an uncle that was the same age as my brother, and he caught it. And I was closer to my uncle than I was to my brother. I spent more time at my grandmother's than I did at home. And somehow he caught it. He's just had this peace and this joy all of his life. And I sat in the same churches with him every Sunday, and I never caught it. I don't know how. You know, I don't know how that happened. But anyway, I worked through those steps, and I got down there, and here I was in a spiritual coma. And I want to tell you, think in your mind for a moment, what is it that just sends that electric shock up your spine today? Is there something that somebody can say, some terminology they can use, or something they can do that just sends it right up your spine? That's what the name God did to me when I got to this program. It sent something shooting up my spine that denoted everything in the world that was a letdown to me. It's when I heard the word God. I did not want to hear that word when I got to this program. And one night I was sitting in a Friday night meeting in the open AA speakers meeting, and they have what they call, I guess California call-up or something. They have a half hour of sharing from the audience, and then they have a break, and then they have the speaker. And I'd been called up to share, and I was just standing up there, and I was just running off, you know, with the mouth and everything, and I heard myself talking about God all the time. And I thought, now when did that happen? Here I am doing the very thing that used to just get me the most. And I didn't even know when it happened to me, was that I was no longer mad at God. Because when I got down to that 12th step, having had, doesn't say, now maybe you might have a spiritual awakening. Or if you have a spiritual awakening, as it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And then I knew what my message was. We tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in our affairs. Now, when I was 6 months in the program, I thought the message was, oh, you need to come to Al-Anon. You need to learn detachment and learn how to release, and you need to how to leave them alone and how to shut up and get off their case. And I thought that was the message. Do you know what the message is? I am spiritually awake. That is my message. This is my experience. It may not be what that 12th step has meant to you, but that's what that step means to me. I can tell you today that I am spiritually awake. I have a God of my understanding. And I commune and communicate with that concept of God on a daily basis. And most of the time, I'm conscious about it. Not all the time. But I am growing in my conscious contact. I am improving that conscious contact. So I come here today to tell you that I am spiritually awake. I know the part of me that always wanted to do things the right way and never could do it. And before, the only reason I wanted to do it, because I didn't want to go to hell. That was the only reason I wanted to do it. There was not another reason. It wasn't because I loved God. It wasn't because I loved my mother and father. As a matter of fact, when I'd say to my grandmother, well, Grandma, what's so good about going to heaven? Well, the streets are going to be lined with gold, and you're going to be with God all day, and the angels are going to sing, and we're going to just live forever. I said, well, what are we going to do while we're living forever? Well, we're going to walk the streets of gold, and we go through the pearly gates. And I said, well, are you going to be there? Yes, but we won't be like family anymore. I said, I don't want to go. I don't want, that is boring. I don't want to do that. It's dead. I don't want any part of it. Now, I'll tell you what. I didn't know at the time how deep a thinking that was. I couldn't have been more than 5 years old. I can remember that we would walk through the doors of that church, and as a small child, before I know, I wasn't accountable for my actions. I mean, I was accountable for my actions, but I didn't have enough understanding. I hadn't been in this, you know, little body and this life long enough to really know what was going on. And I got a thing in the pit of my stomach every time we walked through those doors. And I didn't want to go. And the reason that I didn't want to go is because I sat there and I started having that guilt thrown on me from the time I can remember. It was like it came and the veins on their neck would stand up and they'd come out over that and they'd point. And then, you know, it was the scariest thing. And I'll never forget, I thought it was so unfair when they would say, every head bowed and every eye closed. Now, you know what I did. I was going to peek and see who was raising their hand. And if you don't want to come forward to be saved, okay, whatever that meant was that to me that meant if you don't want to go to hell, then you come on down here. And if you can't do it, just raise your hand and we'll pray for you. And do you know they lied? Well, they didn't completely lie. They did pray for them. But they would send, somebody would go over to that person and start begging them. And I felt so sorry for that person. Now, this is my experience. I'm not telling you that is wrong, okay? That is not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that at all. But what I'm saying is what it happened to me on the inside. You know, in chapter 5, it doesn't say tell what it was like, what happened, what it is like now. We read it again. It says we tell what we were like, what happened, and what we are like today. That's what I was like. I was afraid from the get-go of what was going to happen to me. And my primary purpose in life was to avoid hell, and I wasn't looking forward to going to heaven. And that was where I was growing up with a God. I always thought, well, Jesus is kind of a good guy. You know, he did all good things. So why don't they let him be God instead of God? Because he forgave people, and God is going to get me. God is going to get me. I need to avoid this at all costs, because forever is a long time to burn in hell. And so I would go to sleep at night, and as a teenager, I was raised in a dysfunctional home. I could stand up here and tell you the story of Jane Doe and tell you all my experiences, and it'd be just, you know, the only thing that changes are the names. But I was raised in a dysfunctional home, and I would sneak out once in a while and smoke cigarettes. Now, I want to tell you, everything was a sin in my church. We couldn't even play cards. We couldn't dance. They really didn't believe it was okay to wear makeup and cut your hair. But, you know, we started doing that anyway. Couldn't go to movies. My mother had to sneak me to the movies, which told me something else. Now, she's taking me down there to hear this stuff every week, but she'll sneak me off to the movies, you know. Everything was wrong. I grew up with everything wrong. And then I started dating, and my mother would say, don't let those boys touch you. If you let them get fresh with you, that's the word we use then, if that dates me. If you let them touch you, they won't respect you anymore. Now, I heard that, and boy, I buried that real deep in me. Everything was wrong. Everything was wrong. How could anybody abide by all those rules? You know, they gave me a list like this. It was a real short list. And these are things that you can do. And these are things you can't do. This is not a sin. And this is a sin would fill the room. And this is what God is, and this is what God isn't. And don't ask questions. Now, I ask questions all the time. I still ask questions today. I want to know. I've always wanted to know. So anyway, I went out into life, you know, trying not to smoke, trying not to let those boys get fresh with me, trying not to drink, trying not to go to movies, trying not to dance, trying not to go to hell, trying. And guess what? Didn't work. So I'd go out and smoke cigarettes, and then I'd come home, and I'd spend the rest of the night, and I'd say, dear God, please don't let the end of the world come tonight. I don't want to go to hell. I promise I won't smoke a cigarette tomorrow. Can you imagine all the things I could have been thinking about as a teenager besides that? You know, there were a lot of things, but that's what I spent my time thinking about. I was sent out into life a spiritual cripple. We talk about being sent out into life emotional cripples. I was sent out into life a spiritual cripple. If you don't have some kind of a power greater than you to depend on, then you are really up a creek, and you're not going to have any paddles. So, my mother became my God. And it was real easy because she doted over me, and I was not an only child. I had one brother, but he was 8 years older than me, and I was like an only child. And so my mother doted over me. I knew from the time I was born, I thought, there's something real special in me, and I don't know what it is, but ooh, it's so special. Be honest with yourself and ask yourself, is there some place inside you that once in a while, especially when you were a little kid, that you thought that? Now, it may have gotten squelched along the way, but for me, I kept thinking, there's something special in me. I don't know what it is, but it's somewhere in there, and it's real special. But the longer I lived life, the more it got squelched, and it was just like somebody trying to blow out my little burning candle. Another thing that happened to me when I was 2 years old, I started singing. So they had me up on these podiums singing from the time I was two. And our church would call on the elderly and the sick. Now, this is going to tell you from a feeling nature where I'm coming from. I have never told this stuff in a talk before. But anyway, they would take me out as a little bitty child. Do y'all know how big a two-year-old is and a three-year-old? They would take me out, and I would hear them talking. And there were certain things that would stick in my mind. I remember laying in the crib when I couldn't talk. That's my experience. I remember being in that crib. I remember every morning I woke up because I felt like I was falling, and I would jerk, and then I would start screaming and crying, and my mother would come and get me. Now, I don't know why I remember that, but I do. I remember when she broke me from the bottle, and I remember when she trained me from diapers. I remember those things. So anyway, they would take me to sing, and I would hear them talking, and they would say, "Poor old sister so-and-so is dying." And I would think, "Ooh, that sounds bad." And then they would say, "But we're going to take Jenny to sing for her." And I'd think, "Ooh, that sounds even worse." "Ooh, Jenny doesn't want to sing for her. She doesn't want to look at her. I don't want to touch her." And here's what my concept of death was. I was going to go in that room, and old sister so-and-so was going to be laying there, and she was going to speak to me, and this ball of round germs was going to come out of her mouth, and it was going to be death, and it was going to get on me, and I was going to die too. Now, I really believed that. I was so scared, and then they would get me in there, and it was always quiet. There was never music. Why is it that we think that death has to be, let's make this as sad as possible. Let's make it as quiet. Don't talk. Let's keep it very quiet and very solemn. And which was the opposite of what they were talking about in the church, see, because they all wanted to go there. They called it glory when they wanted to go there, see. This stuff never made sense to me. They wanted to be there so bad till the time came that it was, oh, no. And they prayed. Close those pearly gates for another time, please. And so I was so confused, as to what the deal was. But anyway, they would be real quiet, and someone would come and meet us. And I would have that same feeling as when I went into that church. I didn't want to go in there. I didn't want to participate in that. And then they would prance me in there to stand by Sister So-and-so's bed, and she would look at me. And I'm going to tell you something. There were things I could have said to her as a little child if they'd have just let me talk to her or let me sing the songs I wanted to sing. But they told me what to sing, and they would prompt me along till finally I would realize if I don't sing, I'm not going to get to go home. So I would sing for these people. But you know what happened? This is the good part I remember, because there's good in everything. But what happened was I would see the sparkle in her eye. I don't think I can't remember ever singing for any men. The only ones I remember singing for is women. But anyway, I would see some kind of a light. And then that woman's got the special thing in her that I've got in me, whatever it is. Because I recognized it by that eye. You've heard it said, the eyes are the windows of the soul. I really believe that. They really are. We can see them come in out, and on. They come, crawling through the doors, and the lights aren't on, and nobody's home. And then they're around a little while, and then it starts to twinkle in there. But anyway, those are some of the experiences that filled me and molded me and shaped me into the fear that I was to get into as an adult. Bob also talked yesterday about the experiences that we have here are for our ultimate growth. That's what they're for. I want to tell you that pain is not my enemy. Pain is my friend. Pain tells me when I need to let go. You touch the hot stove and you move it back. And pain is a wonderful thing. And when I let go, the pain eases. I don't say it goes away. I don't say it doesn't hurt anymore. But what more beautiful example did we get to hear than from both those parents yesterday of letting go? They let go. And I can promise that they could tell you that the pain lessened. Did it? It did. It lessened. It doesn't go away, but it's my friend. It's an indicator. What would I do without it? Think about what you would have done in your life if you hadn't felt the pain. Would you be here this morning? I'd be the only one here. That's what got me here. That's what got me here. So having had that kind of background, you can see why I didn't want anybody to tell me about God. And the killer thing, I'm going to mention a couple of things here to clarify myself as an Al-Anon. At 16 years old, I married my first alcoholic. I ran off on a whim. I was not pregnant. There was no reason to do this. I guess you all understand that. So it wasn't like there was a reason to do this. There was never a reason for me to marry an alcoholic. And I've married three alcoholics. And there was never a reason. My mother told me when I was dating, and she was very strict on me and raising me with all these morals and stuff, which most of them I adhered to most of the time. I adhered to most of them most of the time. But anyway, she said, Jan, don't ever date a boy you wouldn't marry. So I didn't. I married him. One of the girls at home I sponsored said, called me, and she said, she was telling me this reason for this guy. She said, you know, she's recently divorced, and she'd been married like 31 years or 32 years or something. She's recently divorced, and oh boy, is she having fun. I'm not really her sponsor. She calls me her freedom teacher. But anyway, she's having so much fun, and she called me, and she said, oh, I just met this fella, and he's so nice. And I want to go out with him, but there's just this one thing, and she told me what it was about him. And I said to her, it was just like I went into my Margie mode. That was my mother's name, Margie. I went into my Margie mode, and I said, well, I'm going to tell you what my mother always used to tell me. Would you be married to him? And she said, no. I said, if for no other reason than the reason you're giving me, would you? Nope. She said, I wouldn't. I said, is there a reason to date him? This is one of the things that was such a problem between you and your husband. Do you need to go to dinner bad enough to have that date? She said, no. I want to tell you, little simple things like that have saved my life since I've come to the program. I compromised myself and compromised myself so many times. Well, anyway, so I ran off and got married for no reason other than it sounded like a good thing to do, because home wasn't so happy. And I was married, and I'll never forget the feeling I had on the way home. I thought, oh my God. Now, I know this sounds funny, but you all will understand this. I thought, oh my God, I'm married. It never occurred to me I was going to really be married when I ran off to get married. My mother had always moved in at the last moment and done something to shake me too, and she laid on the couch and cried when I left. And I was married. I could not get over it. I was like, I'm married. I'm married. Nobody will ever date me again. So I've got to stay in this deal, you know. So I know. That's how 16-year-olds think, you know. So anyway, I thought I can make this work. And I went through that for 10 years and had two beautiful children. I know just the greatest gifts in my life. Two of them are my kids. And then I've got six grandkids and two more on the way. We have to have a den about the size of this room on Christmas, you know. But anyway, that lasted for 10 years. And then I divorced him and thought I was marrying up, see, because I'd always wanted an education. And at 16, it's kind of hard to get married, drop out of school, and be educated. So I'd always wanted an education, so I married an educated person, an educated man, and I started college, and that marriage lasted 9 years. Needless to say, in the first marriage and second marriage, there was no difference. I had married alcoholics, and I did not know they were alcoholics. I want to tell you that alcoholics don't always drink all the time. Sometimes alcoholics drink once a year, and it takes different people a different amount of time for the disease to catch hold to the point that they have to drink, you know, for whatever that their disease demands of them. So naturally, the 19-year-old, it took him a while. He was just progressing fine, you know, by the time I divorced him at 29, but it certainly wasn't anything that I thought would be alcoholism. And then with the second husband, he didn't drink probably once a year. But when he started drinking, he was so cute. We'd go somewhere and they'd offer him a drink. He'd say, yeah. And he'd take that drink. And wherever he set that drink down, and wherever he was, he did not move until we shoveled him out of that chair, you know, into the car and carried him in and put him to bed. Because he would drink until he couldn't move. He couldn't walk. He couldn't talk. He could barely breathe. So that was my first two experiences. But don't give up. I got me a real live one at last. not to worry. And it was, you know, I would like to tell you that at 26, when I remarried, I had learned some lessons and went about it in a different way, but it is not true. It is not true. I married and there was no reason to marry. There was absolutely no reason to marry. It was as dysfunctional in the relationship, as brief as possible, you know. And then, so at the end of 9 years, I thought, I don't have to do this anymore. And I got a divorce. At the same time, my mother had been sick with cancer for about 6 years at this time when I got my divorce. And I went to court to get my divorce. And my mother entered the hospital on about the same day, and to never come out again except to go to a nursing home and then back into the hospital to make her transition into her new life and new experience. But when I was divorced and she had gone into the hospital, and she was the only God that I had, I want y'all to know, and you've heard the background, and my mother always made everything okay. I don't care what it was. I could call my mother and my mother made it okay. And so when she went into the hospital, and then I became the parent. That's what happens a lot of times, you know. We become the parents again, and the caretakers and the nurturer, and that's the way it's supposed to be. That's what parents do. It does, you know, parents are just nurturers. I'd love to know what the root meaning of the word is. I don't know. I really don't know. I've never thought about it till this second. But anyway, when she died, I made a conscious decision that I didn't care what happened to me. Because I didn't have anything to fall back on. I still had two children at home, two teenage children that needed me, and they had been my whole life because I'd never had a marriage worth a hoot, you know. And they were it for me. But I consciously decided this was my way of showing him again. Because, see, I was taught also in that church, now this is the way I was sent out, and these were the tools I had to live by, is that you ask God for something, and you believe it, and you will have it. And I had prayed for 6 years that my mother be healed from cancer. And I want to tell you, folks, I believed it. There wasn't a doubt in my mind. There wasn't a doubt in my mind. And then she died. And then I said to God, you can go hang yourself. I don't care what happens. I don't care what happens to you. I don't care what happens to the world. And I darn sure don't care what happens to me. That's the way I felt on the inside. And I made that conscious decision. And I guess that conscious decision of destruction opened the door for a full blossoming, wonderful, exciting romance of someone who could save me. Now, I didn't know that on a conscious level. There's a lot of things we don't know on a conscious level. But anyway, within a matter of 2 or 3 months, I met the man that I was going to marry that would become my third husband. And I knew from the first date that he was going to ask me to marry him, and I knew I was going to do it, and I knew I didn't love him. Now, I don't know how I knew those things, but I knew him. I knew him. I knew that he was going to ask me to marry. And so we were married within 6 weeks of the first date. So I am happy to report to you that at 36, I didn't do it any better than I did at 26 or than I did it at 16. There's something about every 10 years. My buck is getting real nervous. We're going on 5. But anyway, when I got into this marriage, I knew I was in trouble. I really did. I knew I was in trouble. I had never been touched in my life. I had been threatened. You know, both my first husbands threatened. The first one was going to put a contract out on me, and I said, go ahead. You know, that's fine. You can do that. I didn't have any fear. And the second one grabbed me by the throat the day we were going to court, And he said, it is hot in here. I don't know if anybody can do something about getting the heat turned down, but when you all are fanning too, then I know it's not just me. When we went to court with the second husband, he said to me, I think I'll kill you. And he had me by the throat, and he said, I don't think I can live without you. And I looked him right square dab in the eyes, and I said, you just go right ahead and do it, because I'd rather be dead than live with you. I didn't have any fear. I didn't have any fear of physical violence and threat. But I want to tell you that I came to fruition in this fear that was established in me. And that was the fear of what is something bigger than me that makes all this make sense, because it did not make sense to me. Life did not make sense why you were going to be born just so you could die. Why you spend all this time building relationships with people and with children just so they can die. And then we're going to go someplace where there's no relationships anymore. And none of that made sense to me. So I needed something in my life. I did not know what I needed. And within a matter of days, I knew what trouble I was in. And I became emotionally abused, sexually abused, physically abused, spiritually abused. All of it. And you know, that's what it took for me. I cannot tell you the transformation that has happened in my life as a result of these things. I really believe that these were exactly the things that I needed in my life. I am not grateful that I chose that. I would have much rather, on a conscious level, I would have said, well, I would rather, if I was going to choose something in my life, it would have been somebody that, you know, just yelled at me or something. Or something a little more tame. But I really believe that I am a human being having a spiritual experience. Until I get to the program. And then I become a spiritual being having a human experience. And it changed for me. Because before, that's all I had. I was a human being having a spiritual experience until the experience happened for me in that 12th step. And then I became a spiritual being having a human experience. And that's where I found freedom. That's where I found my freedom. And then we go, at home we have steps here and traditions here. So if you see me going like this all the time, it's out of habit. But anyway, I began to use the principles after the awakening of the traditions in my relationships, which totally changed things. When I was beaten to a bloody pulp, and in my third marriage, which I thought was the worst thing I'd ever done anyway, is to have to be married a third time. Oh yeah, by the way, it was a sin to get a divorce in my church, by the way. One more thing, you know. And so they didn't even say the word divorce out loud. They whispered when they said, she's divorced. Sort of like, she's pregnant. Didn't hear that word out loud till I was in high school. But anyway, I was beaten to a bloody pulp with whiskey in my eyes in the middle of my bedroom floor, knowing the end of a third marriage, and my mother had been dead for 3 months. And I was curled up into a little umbilical position, just wrapped up like a little fetus. And did I have any idea it was going to be my rebirth? No. But that's what it was. There I was. And I said to God, I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. I was screaming as loud as I could on the inside. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. How could you have done this to me? Why did you do this to me? And you've taken my mother, and there's no place for me to go. And I realized, for the first time in my life, I was really praying. And here I was praying to somebody I was scared to death of. I'd spent my whole life to avoid. But I was praying to this God that what a bad situation it was. And the reason I was screaming on the inside is because I was so full of fear that if he woke up, he would come after me and kill me. And I was totally controlled from that day and that moment and that night on until the day I left that marriage, which was 4 years later. As a result of that, we did end up in the psychiatrist's office. I'd been through all the other things in other marriages, you know, all the different ways of getting well and saving marriages. And then we ended up in the psychiatrist's office. This is always interesting. They said, Well, he wouldn't have done that if he hadn't been drinking. So just don't drink anymore, and here is a prescription for some Valium. Well, guess what? He'd been eating those things for years. He carried them in his pocket and ate them. I used to say, don't you want water with those? That's like asking, you know, with the alcoholic, don't you want something to mix with your drink, you know? I didn't know that at the time. But the reason he ate Valium is because he couldn't drink during the day, because he really didn't prefer Valium. He preferred alcohol. And so he ate Valium during the day, and then he would drink at night. Don't you want water? And he said, don't be ridiculous. And, you know, I was different in this thing, Bob. You marked the bottles. I made sure that he had all the Crown Royal in that house that he could possibly have, because I knew how unbearable it was. He said he thought he had died and gone to heaven when he met me, because it was the first person that ever bought that stuff and hauled it in. And I took him from drinking rot gut whiskey to Crown Royal. And he thought, whoa, I'm going to marry her, you know. But I carried that stuff in as much as I could, because I knew it was the only thing that made him halfway comfortable. So I didn't mark bottles. I never did do that. I still had all the other feelings, but, you know. Anyway, as a result of that and going to the psychiatrist, and then I finally remembered this woman that had told me about the love that she'd had for her son and that she'd put him out. And told me why she'd put him out, because she was not going to feed him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, take care of him, give him a place to live so he could work and spend his money on drugs and kill himself. And I never forgot that. I looked at her and I said, you know, I don't know if I know that is the ultimate love, but I don't know if I love my kids that much. And she said to me, I love him enough that I will not kill him with my own money. And I've got goosebumps all over me, because that went into me. I never knew I was living in alcoholic situations. I never knew I was going to need to make that phone call. And when I thought, who can help me? Then I remembered, and I called her. She could understand how degraded I was. She could understand my fear and that stuff. And I called her, and she came over, and she eventually became my sponsor. And she took me. I went single-handedly. By this time, my third husband had ended up, he had just gone completely off, bonkers, and bouncing off the walls. And so what we had done is had him committed, and he was locked up, and convincing me I was crazy. But anyway, I made this 12-step call, and the lady came and talked to me, and what I did was I went over, and I stole him out of the psychiatric hospital with people chasing me down the halls. They told me, he is not bad, he is sick. And if you can get him out of there so that he doesn't end up with the Thorazine shuffle and get him to treatment for his alcoholism and drug addiction, he has a chance for a life. And I single-handedly slipped into the phone booth and put on my cloak and cape and stuff and got up early the next morning and went to the psychiatric, to the regular hospital on their lockup ward and fit right in with those people. So I sat there and I said, yes, I do have something to say. If you all want to spend the rest of your lives down here in the basement of this drippy church, you know, trying to learn how to live with these crazy people, you go right ahead. But if you think I'm going to, you're nuts. That's what I said to them. And they smiled, you know. They just smiled at me and they said, okay, you know. And I thought, they evidently don't understand the seriousness of this. And like I said, I said in the workshop yesterday, they read out of the Bible. They read poems. I didn't know what Alzheimer's cure was for 6 months in the program. They would read these beautiful poems, and the poems would make me cry. And then they would do scriptures and stuff like this. But you know what they had? They had the Al-Anon closing. God, I'm going to tell you something. I can't even say Al-Anon closing with goosebumps going on me. I will never forget. It felt like that I was raw on the inside of my whole body. And as they would read those words, something magical, like a healing something, was just going through me. And by the time they got to the end of that, I was all the way down to, I just was, oh, I never felt like that before, ever. And I had finally entered the doors that were going to introduce me to the way to the God of my understanding. And I don't have time to go through how I worked the steps. But the way I worked the steps was through my alcoholic husband, who had a good, active sponsor. They were rigid. They were dictatorial in that AA group. And I guess that's what he needed. And I'm really grateful for it coming back to me. Not all of it. I didn't have to take all of it. I learned real early I could take what I liked and leave the rest. But they were giving some direction, and I hadn't had any direction up to that point. And so my husband would go to his meetings in a town about 30 miles away and then come home, and he had the sponsor. And I'd say, well, what did your sponsor tell you to do? Because I was real interested in him getting well. And so he would tell me what they told him to do, and he never knew I was doing this, and then I would go do it. So every day I was reading 2 pages in the book, 2 pages in the AA 12 and 12. Of course, I always read my ODAT book and stuff like, you know, I guess at that time, all I had really in the way of that literature was, in the very beginning, was the ODAT book. But I was reading, I was getting on my knees and asking God to help me make it through the day every morning, and getting on my knees every night and thanking God. And I was going to at least 7 meetings a week. And I did that for almost 4 years. And I would think, can I live until 8 o'clock? Can I live until 8 o'clock till I can get to that meeting? And it was 4 years into the program before I began to cut back a little bit in my meetings. That's what I needed. I don't say everybody has to do that, but I couldn't wait to get there. I could not wait to get there. And as a result of that, I became a student of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I became very active in my Al-Anon group, and I was literature chairman and all those things. So I was able to really get into the Al-Anon literature too, and it amazed me, that ODAT book and the love, the wisdom that's in that book. And within a short period of time, I met the lady that was to become my lasting sponsor. And I was about 9 months into the program, I guess, when I asked a lady from Texas to be my sponsor, and found out that she had a hand in writing the ODAT book. And now that I've known her and been living the program with her, I realize that there were many people like that, with that kind of love. And that the listening ability to the God of their understanding to write that stuff the way that it's been written in all of our literature in both programs. I consider the AA program as much part of me as the Al-Anon program, you know, because of my background in it. I found myself in that big book. It wasn't hard at all. It wasn't hard at all. Somebody said, replace the word drinking with thinking, and you've got it made, honey. And so I did. So, as I came to that 11th step, that's when the change for my life started to begin. I didn't have problems. I didn't have a fear of the 4th and 5th step. I really didn't. I don't know why. It doesn't matter. I went through them, but I got down to that 11th step, and it was the first one that sent me reeling, because I thought, meditation. What is meditation? The only time I've heard of meditation is those people that sit cross-legged and you know, fold their arms or whatever it is they do. I had never heard the word meditation other than like in Zen sitting and stuff like that. And so when I got down there, that's how I ended up with Marcy. White is my sponsor from Whitney, Texas. Some of you might know her. I think she's spoken down here. I'm not sure. But anyway, I met her at a meeting in another town and said, what is meditation? How do I do this thing? Because I was going to do all of them to AT so that I would have the promises that the big book talked about. So she gave me a little pamphlet that had just been given to her by an AA fella from the Akron group. And it talked about writing. And this is what I'm going to close with today, is telling you about how my life has been changed from that basket case of negative emotions to somebody that is spiritually awake today. I really know this is a spiritual program. There is not a spiritual part of a program for me. It is a spiritual program. I can look as hard as I want to, and it doesn't talk about recovery, you know, in those steps. See, this is the program right here. This is it. This and then the 12 traditions. That's the program. That's what we work. We don't work the meetings. We don't work the sponsor. We don't work our people that we sponsor. You know, we work the traditions, and we work the steps. That's the program. The other stuff is all the wonderful. This is the wonderful, like Bob says, what did I do to deserve this? That was wonderful. Because that's what I was thinking when I was laying in that little umbilical position. What did I do to deserve this? And now I'm saying the same thing. I sat up there last night for an hour gawking out that window, you know. I really know I do deserve this. I really do know today that I don't deserve it over anyone else. I don't deserve it above anyone else. But I deserve it. I deserve it. I was always the one that was willing to settle for seconds. Always. Even if I ask you, and you don't even know me, to make a choice for me, you would choose better for me than I would be willing to settle for. Anybody would have, then especially the God of my understanding. So when I was told about the listening, and Marcy gave me this little pamphlet, and it said to write. And so, you know, I followed directions, so I got a notebook, and I began to write. And I'm going to share with you the way I do this. And I knew when I met Bob yesterday, I thought, I bet he's a writer. You know, not as in an author-writer, but as in a writer about feelings and the listening. And so I wrote in this notebook how I felt and what was going on in my life. And I addressed it to the God of my understanding. I don't know if this is the way Bob writes, but I know that he does keep notebooks of some kind of writing. And so, you hear in counseling and therapy and all this kind of stuff to keep a journal. Keep a journal. Write your feelings. Teachers have kids doing it in elementary school. Keep a journal. Keep a journal. Write your feelings. Write your feelings. Well, that's wonderful. It is healing. It is relieving. That's what's so healing in writing the inventory, is finally just writing it down and seeing it in black and white. There's something healing in doing that, because most of it is facing it, All right. But then, that's the prayer part for me. Sought. That's an active word, sought. Through prayer and meditation. And the meditation to me is the listening. To improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. How do I improve a conscious contact with anybody? How do I have a relationship with anybody if I don't listen to them? If I do all the talking, it's like I've stood up here today and I've made some eye contact with you, but I do not know anything about you, and you know everything about me. Same thing with God. Same thing with God. If I do all the talking and I do no listening, God knows everything about me. I don't know a thing about God. If I want to know you, I have to sit down with you and say, tell me about you. What do you do? How do you feel? And yet the very power that I'd needed all my life, I had never listened to. Once in a while, I'd pray real hard and I got in trouble, but I always told God exactly how to fix it, exactly how I wanted it, and what the outcome would be. So I got here and I began to listen. So after I wrote everything I was feeling, then it's like I knew. This is all I have to say. Don't have another thing to say. One of the most healing parts of that for me is that I finally have someone that will listen to me and not interrupt. I can talk. My husband, I know, sometimes wishes would she just take a breath. But I'm rarely interrupted when I'm talking like that, and I'm never cut off. Sometimes I'm interrupted, but I'm not cut off in my writings like this. So anyway, I know when I'm through, I don't have anything else to say. I have emptied my vessel so I can be filled. When we're carrying around a full vessel, it's hard to be filled. Until I get my own stuff out of the way, how can I possibly be filled? There's another big, big book that says, you don't pour new wine into an old flask. And I think that's what to me that kind of matches up with half measures avail us nothing. It's kind of the same principle. So when I do this writing and I empty out, and then it's sort of like I go, okay, if you want to talk now, I can listen, because I'm not thinking about what I need to say. And then I begin to hear. The big book says when we begin to practice meditation, and they call it meditation, they don't apologize for it. That part of the big book is so powerful, the suggestions that are made in there. But anyway, as I begin to listen, the sense of belonging came. It was not a belonging to the group, to the Al-Anon group. It was not a belonging to the husband that I was married to. It was not a belonging to my kids. It was not a belonging to my sponsor that is just the most loving, beautiful thing in my life. But it was the belonging to the God of my understanding. It was belonging to the power. And I had finally found what it was in me that was so special. And it was that part of me that can hear. It's that part of me that knows. It's the still small voice I call it my knower within that knows. Excuse me. I call it my knower within that knows. And I want to tell you that I teach very little today, but I do still have a private tutoring school in Shawnee called New Light School. And the reason that it's called New Light School is because some children need to see things in a new light. We all need to see things in a new light. And that came to me in meditation. Isn't that interesting? That I needed to do my own little school? And I said to God, what does it need to be called? And it came right through. I've got the smartest ink pens in the world. They're made by Bic, you know. And it said, New Light School. New Light School. Because some children need to see things in a new light. So, I begin to hear, I love you. You are my blessed child in whom I am well pleased. You are so precious to me. You are beautiful. You are my little princess. It progressed to one day that I could finally accept this when it said, you are my little angel of love and light. Now, I want to tell you folks something. I could never have accepted anybody calling me an angel, because my concept of what an angel was and what an angel really is are two different things. I had a definition and an idea over here. And what I am is I am a little angel. I'm just a little godling down here doing what I'm supposed to be doing, flitting around, you know. And I get off the track sometimes. But there's two parts of me. I'm going to share something that a friend shared, not in the program, really doesn't know that much about the program. But the more I've distinguished who Jan is and who I am, and there is a big difference. Have you ever thought about the power you have when you say, I am sick. I am mad. I am whatever. You know, I am tired. And he was talking about addressing people that when the alcoholics, he didn't know about Al-Anon, I don't guess much. But he said, I've always thought in those meetings, if they really knew the difference between who they think they are and who they really are, who the personality is and who they really are, they'd get up and say, hi, my name is Jan, and she's an alcoholic. And I thought, they'd probably roll them if I'd go down there this morning and tell them, you know, my name is Jan, and she's an Al-Anon. But really, that I have a distinction today, and that's why I can forgive myself when I don't do it perfectly. A lady asked me yesterday about defects of character and how do you ever get over them and how hard it is. And I said, I don't plan that I'll ever really be completely over mine. And when I do, you all need to all buy a ticket and come watch, because I'm going to go, and just, you know. You just be there going, oh, yay! But that's, to remove them is a process. We practice these principles, and it's a process. Life is a process for me. It's a process. And the most important thing that the Al-Anon program has allowed me to do is to accept Jan and forgive Jan and know that I'm not always going to do it right, and it's okay, and that's not just to pass it off. I'm not passing it off saying, well, it's okay. It's okay, Jan. I don't feel that way about it. On the inside, I feel like it's okay. It's okay. That's all right. Did you learn from this experience? So whatever in this spiritual process that I'm going through, that these steps led me to, a God of my understanding, that I no longer have to live in a relationship where I'm abused. I no longer have to keep doing the things I didn't want to do and never be able to do the things I did want to do. I don't have to avoid going to hell and choose heaven as a boring alternative. You know, I'm just going to be. I'm not even worried about that. That stuff is... Listen, I've come so far, the last thing I got to try to do is analyze what's going to happen after this. You know, I really mean that. Just to be. I'm just going to be. And to be this spiritual person that is a conscious contact. A conscious contact that I am aware when I'm awake that I am a spiritual being having a human experience. And I have learned about handling the death process since I've come into this program, because before it was the scariest thing in the world to me. I mean, it was the end. Thank you. Close the door. The end. And today, when we experienced through Bob White, and I don't know if any of y'all ever heard him talk when he was living, but what a powerful, loving, precious, sugary man. He called, even called men sugar. He wouldn't. He'd call them precious. But we played music when he was sick, and we laughed. And we gathered around the body that was left, you know, in the room when he was laying in state. And we told stories, and we were in the room with him, and, you know, and we cried too. I'm not saying we didn't cry, because we did. I mean, we just, golly, you know, from way toes up. But, and we wore white instead of black. And we lived and put into practice what we had been talking about. We lived it and we put it into practice. And that was the most wonderful, that was another freeing experience, is to know that there are, is an, another way to be able to handle the death process for me. I can celebrate life today because I'm no longer afraid to die. And I've heard it said that when you're afraid to die, you're afraid to live. This program has given me my life. This program is my life. I am remarried today to a non-alcoholic man. And he just loves everything I do. He said, you know, I don't, he said, people ask me all the time, what does your wife do? And I say, I don't know, but I just love it. And I wanted to keep on doing it. He really lives the program. There are people out there that live that program. And I know if I hadn't taken the time to work those steps and find my own recovery, that I could have never attracted somebody like him into my life. He sends me off every time I go somewhere and just leaves me totally free. So now I even have a relationship in my life that where I have freedom. You all have given that to me. I just have to tell you this. It just came flying into my mind. This is how sick I was. I really related to this joke. I guess y'all have heard all the dumb blonde jokes that are going around. Shamey, shamey. But I called a girl that I sponsor, who's also one of my very best friends, Friday night when I got in here, and she says, well, I just have to tell you this. And I related to how this girl thought, because this is about how much I was able to make sense out of things. She said, do you know what the dumb blonde said when she found out she was pregnant? I hope it's mine. And that's about how much sense I made when I came in here. You know, today I know it's mine. I know my own children. I know why I wear shoulder pads. I know why there's white out on the screen. How do you know if the dumb blonde has been on the word processor, all the white out on the screen, you know? I know those things today. I'm awake. Thank God I'm awake. So I want to thank you for having me here and for bearing with the heat. I love every one of you. I honestly do. The Southern... Oh, I know another thing I wanted to thank you for. The ease that I felt here. You know, the Serenity Volunteers for Serenity. I cannot tell you when I have been in a conference that there's no hustle or bustle here. There was none of it. And it's just sort of laid back. I'm used to going in and having things, you know, lined right out. And you go places, you never know how they do it there, see. And it's like, I'm used to going in and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So I came in and I said, okay, well, what are the plans for dinner? Because there's always plans for dinner. She says, and I'm going, what if I do the wrong thing? Where am I supposed to be somewhere? And I said, well, is there, you know, like, are people going to get together or something? She said, and I said, well, is there something I'm supposed to do for dinner? She said, you can do anything you want. Oh, please tell me what I'm supposed to do. You know, she said, well, you can eat in the hospitality room. Or she said, there's a restaurant over here. I said, what are you going to do? She says. So I caught on real quick. Nobody gave me that feeling. The feeling here has just been, it was just so wonderful, the ease and the comfort I felt to just be. And I thank you for giving that to me. God bless.